listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. I am Louise Steinman, the curator of the Aloud series, which is presented to you. I thank you. It's been just over a year since the revolution that swept the Egyptian president Hosni Mubarak out of office and ushered in a new era that is still unfolding moment by moment, as you can see from the front page of the Times this morning. And from Moscow to Syria to Yemen, the voices of protest inspired by the Arab Spring continue to reverberate around the world. Egyptian internet activist Wael Ghonim was one of the most prominent faces. That's my cue for please remember to turn off your cell phones. Thank you so much. Was one of the most prominent faces of the Egyptian Revolution. And now with his new book, Revolution 2.0, The Power of the People is Greater Than the People in Power, which is a great title, we all agree, we can learn the story of that revolution's birth in Wael's written words, and tonight we can hear him in person in conversation with author and scholar Reza Aslan. Wael Ghonim was an unlikely candidate for a revolutionary mastermind. At the beginning of the campaign, he was a computer specialist who had studied business at the American University. He'd founded multiple companies, including one of the leading financial websites in the Arab world. At the start of the revolution, he was working a dream job as Middle East marketing director for Google in Dubai. We Are All Khaled Said was the name of the Facebook page that Wael masterminded while coordinating the protests. Khaled Said, I'm sure you'll hear more about him tonight, was a blogger beaten to death by corrupt state police. Ghonim's first post read, "Today they killed Khaled. If I don't act for his sake, tomorrow they will kill me." For his safety, Wael used screen names. Not even his friends knew that it was Wael posting these emotional first-person statements. In his book, Wael describes his upbringing, the incidents that galvanized his anti-regime activism, and how he guided the protests using the internet. He talks about how state security, which discovered his identity, captured him, spirited him away blindfolded to a prison cell where he was brutally interrogated and kept in isolation for 12 days while the revolution churned on without him. When he emerged, his country had changed, in part due to his actions, and Wael faced some of the biggest decisions of his life. Our moderator tonight is the multi-talented Reza Aslan, who last interviewed Salman Rushdie for Aloud. He's the author of the best-selling No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam, and editor of Tablet and Pen, Literary Landscapes from the Middle East. He's also the founder of Aslan Media, an online journal for news and entertainment about the greater Middle East and the world. We are always very grateful for Reza's insights into politics and culture, and it gives me great pleasure. Please join me in welcoming Wael Ghonim and Reza Aslan.
Thank you. Wael Ghonim, ahlan wa sahlan. We spent about 5 minutes downstairs actually arguing about who would go first. That's what Middle Easterners do. It's a great pleasure to be here on stage and to talk to you about this remarkable book, Revolution 2.0, The Power of the People is Greater Than the People in Power. Just a reminder that the book will be available for sale afterwards and for a signing. It's kind of a strange book tour that you're on right now. We're in a you're here to talk about a revolution that's still going on. It puts you in an awkward position. I understand that, and we will be a little bit careful about the way we tackle certain topics, because the fact of the matter is that you're not just here in front of an audience in Los Angeles, but you're in front of an audience back home in Egypt as well. But I do want to start with what's going on right now in Egypt. There's enormous unrest as we sit here, as you know. In fact, you were just there not too long ago, a few days ago, not just in Egypt, but across the region. There have been deadly protests, not just the Port Said incident, but also in the wake of that incident. The military is still very much in charge, as you know. There is still mass arrests, military trials, tortures that are still taking place in prison. And the economy is in a very poor shape. The GDP went from 5% to 1% in the last year. Youth unemployment is still at 25%, around where it was before the revolution. Yep. Foreign investment has gone from $6.4 billion a year ago to $500 million today. And of course, you know, there are still worker strikes, very little foreign help, as you know. I guess what I want to start with before we kind of go back in time is I want to talk about the present right now. Tell me, first of all, what is it like to be here in the United States, you know, on this tour, when obviously your heart is back with a revolution that is still very much in process?
Well, it's I have to say it's very hard actually to be here away from the country. I was in the book tour in London when the Port Said events happened, and I was rethinking with, you know, should I go back home or continue with the tour, given that I'm donating all the proceeds to Egypt back. And it was a very tough decision because I do have a job, just like everyone else, to finish what we have all started together. And I actually asked my friends, what do they think? And I got 100% of them saying, you have to go to the U.S. and tell the story. And things are developing in the country. So I pretty much disagree with what he described. The situation can be described as what Reza said, but let me try my skills in describing a different perspective. In 12 months, Egypt... have done the impossible. The Egyptians have overthrown Hosni Mubarak, a dictator that had been there for 30 years.
Yeah.
And his son, who is supposed to be the next president, which was rumored to be approved by the U.S. administration, is now in prison. And don't keep clapping, because there are lots of things I can... His government, most of them are now facing corruption charges. His party, the National Democratic Party, that was basically controlling the life in Egypt for tons of years, have been dissolved. And we are seeing all the Egyptian syndicates are being free now, and there had been elections. Students, for the first time, go to schools where the deans of these schools have been elected by the professors of the school. And we are seeing new syndicates, especially for farmers and workers, being formed freely. We are doing things on the street that we have never been able to do in 13 months ago. And most important, Egyptians have broken, critical mass of Egyptians, I cannot generalize to all Egyptians, have broken the fear. Which was one of the barriers to democracy in our country. Most of the people were frustrated, but they were scared. They did not want to take action because they did not want to pay the consequences. And all of a sudden now, everyone is ready to sacrifice even the most precious thing, their lives, for a better country. And the amount of political engagement that taken place in the last few months were enormous. 27 million Egyptians, for the first time, since I was born as an Egyptian, I see Egyptians, one, standing in line. For anyone who visited Egypt probably will know that this is by itself is a big achievement. And for hours waiting to cast their votes and choose whomever they want in the parliament, and it actually happens. So while I completely agree with exactly what you have said, it's very important for us to remember the achievements we have done. It's very important to remain optimistic about the future of this country, because this is the only way that we can appreciate the sacrifice of those who died, and this is the only way we can honor the commitments when we went to the street on 25th. We wanted this country to change. It is happening. It is changing. But we are recovering from 60 years of military rule, 30 years of dictatorship. It's not going to go like this. We thought it would. Mm-hmm. We were kind of, you know, sort of, this is sort of immaturity, expected immaturity. Most of us are apolitical, and we don't understand how politics work. But let's always make sure that we see the whole situation as it is.
You talked about, you know, two prevailing sentiments that I think up until, you know, quite a little while ago was prevalent in Egypt, not just amongst the youth, but in general, and that was fear and apathy. Nobody, I mean, you know, as you know, that there are elections in Egypt. There were elections in Egypt. I mean, Mubarak actually bothered to run unopposed, but you know, very few people actually cared. I mean, politics was just not a topic of conversation. It's just something that people, that you know, in my experience of Egypt, it wasn't an issue anymore. No, people wouldn't talk about politics, and now it's all they talk about.
Because for the first time in our history, people feel that their opinion matter. They can see that their actions are the ones. It's not the closed rooms, the 0.001% of the population that would make decisions on everyone's behalf. Actually, you can lobby and you can pressure and you can protest and you can see the result of that happening. There's definitely disadvantages to this, given, you know, all this power all of a sudden given to people while they haven't really matured and to know when to stop and when you know when to take action. Mm-hmm. Yet people for the first time were empowered and they saw that their opinion matters. They can change things
and they can have an influence in their lives. What's going on right now?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've seen a lot of examples of Egyptians going to the polling stations. Like my uncle, for example, is a 74 years old guy who never voted in his whole life, thinking that, you know, this is just a game. I mean, why would I be part of this game? There's no point. I know NDP is going to win anyway, and there's no point of participating. And he did. Go despite he's actually very, you know, he's not in a very good physical condition, and he insisted on going. And so as many Egyptians, we've seen amazing photos of senior Egyptians taking to the streets and even telling the young guys, you know, for the first time in our lives, you have done something we thought it would have never be done before we die.
We wanted to start with the present. We'll come back to the present in a moment, and we'll talk about the past. But the future. But let's go to the past for a bit. Let's go to a year ago. You start the book with a kind of a humorous anecdote about being called in front of the you know the state security services, and you're kind of nervous, right? You're nervous because you think that that they know about your online activities and that those are the questions that they're going to ask you. But they don't ask you about that, do they? What do they ask you about instead?
So just to tell people, I was on sort of a watch list since 2001 for some reason, and mainly because I came from, you know, I left the U.S. after September 11th, and I have nothing to do with it, I swear to God. And they put me on that list for some reason in back home, and since then, every time I go to the airport, they stop me and say, okay, you know, we'll come back home. And then when I traveled a lot in 2007, they you know, not arrested me, they called me and said, hey, listen, we need to, you know, grab some...
Come and have a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, you have that too here?
it happened for a while over here too, as a matter of fact, yes.
Yeah, so I went there, and most of the conversation is, who are you? What are you doing? What are the kind of activities you do? And I was, in the first chapter of the book, I was trying to explain to the people through my story that how state security, despite the fact that you probably have visited Egypt and seen the pyramids and, you know, had a nice life, had a nice time there, you don't really get to know the details. The country was pretty much controlled by state security. They know everything. They file on everyone. They want to know. They want to log in your activities in your file, and they make, you know, very, you know, strategic decisions, as well as they make, you know, decisions on, for example, who is going to be the next teacher assistant in a university, because they don't want the teacher assistants who are considered as opinion leaders to be related to any political or religious groups. And they definitely ask you about your religion, you know, what are the mosques, I think this is familiar. Yeah, what are the mosques you pray at, and you know.
And that's what they were asking you, right? They were asking you about sort of your religious affiliations, and and you know, they wanted to know just how much of a Muslim are you?
Yeah. Muslimometer.
It's funny too because you say something in the book at the end of that experience that I think is really astute. You say that if the state security services, because you were, again, you were quite nervous that they were going to ask you questions that actually could have gotten you in trouble as opposed to the questions that they were asking you. And you say something to the effect of that, you know, if the state security services had spent just a little bit more time thinking about the internet instead of how to classify people according to their religious affiliations, they might have been prepared for what's coming. But instead, they were obsessed, and I think obsession is the right word, they were obsessed with, in particular, the Muslim Brotherhood and about the idea of religious
The religious groups in general. I think they never thought that the young people would revolt against them. They didn't see it coming. They didn't see the mainstream taking an action. And this is because what I tried to explain in the book, what I call the tools of mass oppression, they basically had the fear using the state security as well as the various techniques to make you always scared. And then they have the media, which is the propaganda tool, where they use it against anyone who dare to go against them and basically oppose their positions. And they pretty much control the legal system. You can be in court or you can be, you know, as well as they launch smear campaigns against you. They make you lose your businesses if you are a businessman. So it was pretty much under their control. And they didn't, they didn't really see that the amount of frustration could, at the end of the day, mount into a snowball, and no one can. That is unstoppable.
Right. Well, what's funny is, I brought up the Muslim Brotherhood, and I do want to talk about that for a little bit because in the United States, this is all we ever talk about. I mean, it's just as much as the old state security services were obsessed with the Muslim Brotherhood. That's true, I think, of Americans too. And from the very beginning, from the first moments of the January 25th. Protests, you had politicians in America, the media in America saying, this is all the Muslim Brotherhood, a cabal, right? That Egypt is about to become the next Iran. We had people like Mike Huckabee, who you probably don't know, but I will tell you, if you knew him, what you would realize about him is that he would make a great member of the Muslim Brotherhood. talking about, the sort of Islamic takeover of Egypt, etc. And, of course, that's exactly what you hear from Mubarak and his cronies, the exact same words. What do you ascribe that fear of the Brotherhood to? What do you, not just the Brotherhood, but in general, of sort of politicized religion or religion as an opposition force. What do you ascribe the overwhelming fear that you experienced from the Mubarak regime and then, here in the United States? What is that about?
Well, I want to first take a step back and, we need to honestly ask ourselves, do we really believe in democracy or not? If the belief in democracy is restricted to we believe in democracy as far as it brings those who we like in power, then
that's about right.
That is not democracy. That is basically.
Yeah.
So didn't work. I think a lot of people didn't like that comment.
I think it's the Brotherhood crowd.
So the same, if you start using the same arguments a dictator used to use, that you are probably not doing the right thing.
Well said.
Yeah, at the end of the day, what matters is how did anyone come to power? Did they come to power using the fair and free elections, or they came to power by using force? In fact, I personally took to the street, not because I thought Mubarak is a bad dictator, and we need to bring in a good dictator and basically replace the bad dictator with a good dictator and Egypt will be fine. I think I'm talking personally. I'm not sure if I you know, I think a lot of Egyptians would agree to this. We took to the streets because we think that the Egyptians were denied the right to choose whomever governed them for so many years, and it did us nothing but pain, frustration, anger, poverty, corruption, and it's about time that we choose whom we want and we bear the consequences as a nation. And this is what, you know, I learned in schools that this is what they call democracy.
That's right. It's interesting, too, because what I think it's very difficult for an American audience to understand is that while we may look at some of these religious opposition groups, like the Brotherhood, but not just the Brotherhood, while we may look at them as sort of frightening and you know, as dangerous and perhaps even theocratic, people in the region see them as more or less the only uncorrupted group left. Because you say something in the book that I thought was really touching, that the corruption of the regime, the Mubarak regime, was so complete and total that it permeated every sector of Egyptian society, that people were corrupt, businesses were corrupt, the police were corrupt, the bureaucrat, I mean, that corruption became a way of life, except for, you know, these kind of religious oppositional figures who at least in the minds of the people, were able to kind of...
And I wouldn't, you know, there were definitely many Egyptians who were not corrupt. It was just very hard for you to live, to get through your daily life without having to get into positions where, you know, you're exposed to bribes, for example, and so on. I would really say that regardless of the election results, one thing I'm happy for is that we're all now in the field. In the past, those who were ruling us did make decisions on all of our, you know, on our behalf. And at that time, it was pretty easy for anyone, any group, to sit back, watch the game, and start commenting, making idealistic views, talk about idealism and, you know, what should happen, and this is not going in the right direction, you know, because you know that for a fact that you're not going to get in power. It's very easy to sit down and comment. One good thing that is happening now, and you know, on the optimistic view, the way I see it, is that we became all within the problem. We are all in the field now. And the field, to me, as I read it, the serious stuff in the field is economy. In Egypt, almost one out of every two people live under $2 a day. And the people are really in a very bad position. There are lots of very poor people. One out of every three uneducated, illiterate. So anyone who comes in and trying to fix the wrong problems that people are not complaining about at the moment are going to actually face huge anger from the people, especially in a time of a revolution where everyone is outspoken, everyone wants to see the real change happening. And I also think that we have done a lot of, you know, we need to give anyone... Regardless of the Muslim Brotherhood, I'm not here as a representative of the Muslim Brotherhood to keep defending them, but regardless of anyone coming in, we should sort of remove the preconceived stereotypes. They are now in action. Let's see how they perform. And I wouldn't care too much about what they have said in the past, what they have said in media, because those were the idealistic views that, you know, probably I can sit down and lecture about them. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to action, life is very, you know, different. And finally, you know, democracy does not necessarily come with everyone, you know, choices. I as an Egyptian, I was very worried when I saw George W. Bush being reelected in the U.S. I don't know how many people agree with me here, but but what I noticed is that the American people have sort of like everyone, even those who disagreed with. Have agreed to, you know, they did not march in the street calling, you know, the people want to get Bush out of the out of the regime. So if we want to establish a system, we should sort of forget about who is running it and focus on the core. What is this system looking like, and how to make sure that this system is gonna be maintained for very long? And this is what I care about as an Egyptian at the moment. And I want to help anyone whomever is in power, even if I disagree with, simply because at this stage, this is not like, you know, we're sitting down and talking about the bright future. We are sort of rescuing this country, rescuing the people. I met someone who had been sleeping on the floor for 3 months because he cannot afford to fix his broken leg. Just a simple operation at a hospital. He does not have the money for it. If anyone comes in and, you know, save this guy, and this is the very basic human rights that pretty much no one is talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, poverty in Egypt is the biggest violation of human rights because a lot of these people are suffering, and their suffering is so bad, and no one cares about shedding the light on their, you know, their painful experience. So if anyone comes in and rescue these people, I will definitely give them a hand, regardless of whomever they are, whether I agree or disagree with their ideologies and their, you know, their style.
Yeah, in any democracy. That's right. I mean, in any democracy, it's the, you know, the results. I mean, what do you promise and what can you deliver? Not, you know, what your ideology is. Let's go back and let's talk a little bit about the road that you took as a reluctant internet activist. It began with Mohammed Al-Baradei, the former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, very well-respected Egyptian, finished his post at the IAEA and made this kind of sudden announcement that, you know, he's going to go back to Egypt and perhaps, you know, run against Mubarak for president. And this was an exciting moment for you, wasn't it? It was actually the first moment in which you kind of decided, I want to be a part of this. You started a Facebook page.
Yeah, absolutely. Before that, we're both scared and hopeless. The very common question that comes in the minds of many of the middle class, the apolitical people, not the activists, because the activists actually, and I have to give them a lot of credit for the amazing work they have done from 2004, where they started for the first time saying "down, down, Hosni Mubarak," which was very brave. Yeah, Kfaya movement. Many, you know, 6th of April. Many of those young and senior activists as well. Those were the brave people because they stood up on the front lines and they were ready to do a huge sacrifice.
Just to explain, the April 6th movement is the young is the strike that took place. It started at the Al-Mahalla textile factory. It was a remarkable strike that ultimately resulted in the first minimum wage law in Egypt. Yes.
So, as most of the apolitical mainstream would tell you, you know, first of all, there is a price to pay, and you don't really see the result. You know, you don't see any hope. What is the alternative to Mubarak? That's the biggest question people used to ask. And the answer of like anything is going to be better. Yeah. Anyone is going to be better. It was not convincing to most of the people, so that they can sacrifice. And when Mohammed Al-Baradei expressed his interest, one thing I personally noticed that a lot of my friends started to talk about this, and that was getting like bigger and bigger. And mainly the young people who were frustrated. We were the generation that, you know, were born. And we never saw any president other than Mubarak. It's such, you know, I know, you know, can you imagine the most loved president of the U.S. being there for 30 years? No, it's very hard. And it's not funny as well. And when he came, we were like, okay, this could be something. This could be a moment. And ultimately, a lot of us online start to think we should do something about it. A brave guy started a group where he said Al-Baradei 2011 presidency, and politics just got into me. And because of my frustration of, you know, I hate injustice, I hate seeing people suffering, I didn't know what to do, and I was just trying to help with charity and stuff like that. But when this moment came, I truly felt I should do something, and I started with creating a page on Facebook, hoping that as soon as Al-Baradei, you know, like, become campaigning for his, you know, campaigning, he would have this platform on Facebook to communicate with the people.
Yeah, I should say, you didn't coordinate with Al-Baradei. Yeah, you just started the page.
Yeah, I started the page, and I acted like him, basically. I started getting some of his quotes, and And I was trying to make this the official page. And it was very funny. Many of the comments were talking to me as if I was at Baraday. Well, and a lot of people were just like, what are you doing on Facebook? You shouldn't be wasting your time on Facebook. Go to the streets. And of course, you know, I wouldn't say until I met his, you know, I emailed his brother and I say, listen, I think at that time we had like, I had another administrator. I have to give him a lot of credit because no one hears his name. His name is Abdurrahman Mansour. He was a great guy. He's now in the army service.
He's in the book a lot, yeah.
Yeah, I mentioned the whole story about him in the book. And when I called, I tried to reach out to Al-Baradai through someone, and I told his brother, listen, I have this page. And he didn't seem like, you know, he
didn't get it.
Yeah, he didn't seem like, okay, you know, I have this page where I have 80,000 members, I don't remember the exact number, who are fans of Al-Baradai, and I want to make sure that he can get it and he can use it. And since then, I met him in person for the first and probably the last time before the revolution to basically discuss suggestions and ideas.
But what's interesting about that page, though, that Facebook page, is that, first of all, not only did Al-Baradai all of a sudden realize after a while, oh, this is actually pretty helpful, and began to support the page. But it also became a kind of clearinghouse for anti-Mubarak sentiment, didn't it? I mean, it was sort of, as you say, you know, for the first moment, you thought, well, if not Mubarak, then who? And all of a sudden, there was a who for the first time ever. And that sort of that page became a place where Egyptians started to you know, expressing their
it was
what
also
I would call
happening
revolutionary
on a large scale on the group as well. Like the basically one which I, you know, I pretty much detailed in the book. We tend to be braver behind the keyboard. Simply, we are much braver when we don't, because you are not in direct confrontation with someone, and this is a minus for also. Many reasons. People are much more aggressive online when they communicate, especially with people they don't know. They, you know, celebrities or so. Now go to any Facebook page of any celebrity and see the amount of comments where people are basically trashing him or sort of. So people are braver online, and in Egypt, when you have such a regime, you will tend to, you know, get all your, you know, frustrations out online. Or you know, around your common friends and so on. But if you want it to reach a larger audience, you would do it online. So there was this, as I said, clearly mounting anger. Not just online. Online is at the end of the day, it's the tool. But the people were angry. They were just channeling a lot of their anger online, and they were collaborating and trying to find ways to basically get rid of Mubarak.
And this was really the first time that you started seriously thinking that, wow, this could actually be a tool for something beyond, statuses, Facebook statuses, and things like that. This could be a tool for change, because you saw that anger online in a way that people would never dare express on the streets.
Yeah, so when for example, Khaled died, I thought, aside from my emotions and from my frustration, I thought that at the end of the day, in order, the last thing a dictator wants is that you expose them. Dictators, if you study any dictatorship, they use fear, but at the same time, they use certain kind of brainwashing to make sure that most of the people would believe in their messaging or, you know, swallow it, I would say. So the last thing they do want is basically exposure. Exposure to their crimes or their corruption. They want as least people to know that something is happening.
Sure.
So I wanted to use that. And I personally, I'm a full believer of the internet. I met my wife online. Most of my jobs were online. So I always believed that internet is going to change the face of politics in Egypt. And I tweeted, I think in April 2010, the internet is going to change the face of politics in this country, and the presidential elections in 2005 is in 2011 is no way going to be like the one in 2005. So we ended up having no elections in 2011 anyway.
Yeah, so then that was true. The Khaled you were referring to is Khaled Said, young man as Louise mentioned, who was beaten to death by by the Mukhabarat, the secret police.
Amn al-Dawla, we call it. Mukhabarat is the intelligence. This is the CIA of Egypt.
So this was the police.
Yeah, the FBI of Egypt.
Yeah, right. And of course, that's a common occurrence. I mean, that's that kind of activity happens, in the Mubarak era all the time. The difference is that this time, as you say, there was a decision to actually expose this, and that's when Kulina, Khaled Saeed, the Facebook site We Are All Khaled Saeed, was formed. Tell us a little bit about that site and why you made it and what the response was.
So the difference in this case was that there was a photo. There was sort of an evidence, and that the victim is young, 30 years old, or I think at the time he was 20. Now he's 30, if he was alive. He was born on 27th of January. He was 28 years old. The photo of after the math was there. It started, going around on Facebook, and people were angry, and they, to a large extent, knew that this is not like a single case. This is not the shooting of one individual or, the killing of one individual that just happens once and never happens again. It was systematic. And the reason why it is systematic is that no one is held accountable and that most of the techniques of the police are based on violence. They lack the tools and they lack the training on there's no need to do that anyway. If, in Egypt, they say that to know if someone did steal or not, you just get him and keep beating the hell out of him until he says the truth, and this is pretty much how it was happening, and there were many victims, so it wasn't just me; it was many people. Many people thought that this is unacceptable. This needs to stop, and I thought of, we've got to expose the dictator right arm, which is, to a large extent, the police, the Ministry of Interior Affairs, hoping for nothing but actually change within them, wanting to see, like, for example, they were going to be more cautious in dealing with cases. They now understand that it's no longer, someone is going to die, and you can pressure on the mass media and tell them, don't talk about this, and it's not going to happen. Now, things are, media is more decentralized, and I think this is one of the best trends for a guy like me. Some others would think this is very bad, but one of the best trends in the world that we're living in now is everything is getting decentralized, and people are more empowered without filters or barriers or those in media to say what should go and what should not and how it should go. I, as an individual, I can actually communicate with people. In fact, the page, which Kulina Khaled Saeed now has 1.9 million people, which I can communicate with. This could be a good thing, and it could be also a very bad thing. Depends on how are you going to use it.
One thing that was kind of remarkable about the Kulina Khaled Saeed page is that page was the first moment in which there was a genuine leap made from the virtual world to the real world. In other words, that page, which ultimately resulted in a couple of fairly significant protests, you call them silent protests, and I'd love you to talk a little bit about that. But I also want you to talk about what that was like, and the challenges of going from a place where you're anonymous, you're in the dark, you can type whatever you want, you can say whatever you want about Mubarak, and then also moving from there to the point where you're actually standing on a street corner now, actually exposing yourself to possible retribution.
Yeah. So I wouldn't give credit to the page for that, because it happened before the page that people would announce events online and then take them, go to the streets, and based on the events. Yet the page style was very non-confrontational, and that is not because there was a master plan behind it. It was because
that was your decision. It was a strategy to be non-confrontational. Yeah,
I'm an apolitical person. All what we want, we're not here in the political game. And as Egyptian, I want to see the police accountable for their actions, and I'm not there to fight with anyone. And that, to a large extent, shaped the success of the page without, you know, it was pretty unintentional, yet consciously done, because this was me. That was a reflection of me as an individual. So one guy, when I opposed the idea of protesting, because I thought this is putting people's life at risk, you know, what if someone get arrested based on the emergency law that, you know, you kind of have the very close law to that one now here in the U.S.
Yeah, to put it in the easiest way, the most simplest way to understand it as possible, the emergency law allows the government to do whatever it wants to whomever it wants for however long it wants, whenever it wants to.
Isn't that a Patriot Act or not?
Yes. So it's a little bit, you know, we certainly have our own problems with a police state, but yeah. And by the way, I mean, I think it's important to understand, we'll talk about this later, that law is still very much in place.
Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
So basically, one guy came and said, why don't we go to the street, face the, you know, we have beaches or, you know, the Nile, mm-hmm. Facing the Nile or the beach, and our backs to the street. We stand up silently, each one every, you know, 1 meter, there is a gap between each one and another, and we're all wearing black. Wow, that's an interesting idea. I just visualized it the moment he sent the
signs,
email.
No chants, no slogans, just...
Nothing, and we wouldn't say anything. It's not anti-Mubarak. It just sends a message, we're not happy with what's going on, and we're very peaceful, and we want to go home in 1 hour. And I remember, you know, the feedback that came was very... some people loved it, basically those who don't want to be in confrontation with anyone. They, you know, you call them, you know, less brave or whatever, but... They are just normal human beings who have fear and they have a lot to lose, and I was one of those. And others, like activists, they were starting cracking jokes about this. You know, you're telling me that a protest in front of the Ministry of Interior Affairs where people are chanting down, down Hosni Mubarak is going to be less effective as this? If the regime is ignoring that, why would they care about such a silent stand? And I remember one joke is like, you know, this time is going to be a silent stand, the next time you're going to be on vibration, you know. So people had mixed opinions about it, but the fact of the matter is the silent stand did activate a lot of the people who were like me, who do not want to be in confrontation with the regime, who just want to send a peaceful message that I'm not happy. And thousands of people joined. It was a very nice image. And I believe that eventually, as the more we did them, the more the authorities did not like them. Because at the end of the day, and this is what I've personally came up with, my conclusion is that any dictator wants their opponents to be extremists. If mm-hmm. if I am a dictator, I want the most extreme, crazy people to be against me. Why? Because I want to tell my people, look, these are the ones...
It's me or them.
Yeah, these are the ones who basically don't like me. Are you one of those, you know, crazy... And they do, intentionally or unintentionally, that's how it works, they do put a lot of focus on these people. They oppress them, they expose them to a lot of injustice, and they end up becoming more aggressive than the average Egyptian. And the communication channels tend to be cut. And this is a great deal of things I mentioned in the book. It's my personal experience. Someone might read it and say, listen, this all doesn't make sense. But at the end, I just felt that it's very important. If you want justice, if you want people to believe in the cause, it's sort of, you have to convince them. It's a conversion process. You have to make sure that every day there are 10 or 20 more people believing in the cause. I know it's very interesting and relieving that, you know, all the frustrated people sit down in one room and keep screaming and, you know, psych each other up that something needs to happen. But at the end of the day, if you lose the, you know, if you don't bridge with the mainstream, you are not going to be able to make the change. And that was the page philosophy. And this is why, for example, this page, I never wrote down Hosni Mubarak because I believe it was not useful, it was not good. It was just, you know, yes, 50,000 people will be happy, but then 300,000 people would not like to see this confrontational approach on the page. The first time I wrote it was on 27th of January.
Well, and then something interesting happened, though, not long after the Kulina page and the silent stands, which is that Mohamed Bouazizi, the young Tunisian, set himself on fire. That resulted in mass protests throughout Tunisia, ultimately got rid of the 20-year dictatorship of Zine Abidine Ben Ali. And you say something in the book which I totally, as an Iranian, I completely understand where you're coming from when you say this, but you say that as excited as you were, obviously, about what was happening in Tunisia, your pride was kind of wounded, like the Tunisians?
No, I didn't say that.
I said that.
He's putting words in my mouth.
What you said was that the pride of Egyptians had been challenged by what happened in Tunisia, and things began to accelerate very, very quickly.
The first page I dedicate a thank you to Tunisia. So
we all love Tunisia, but. But the fact of the matter is that Egyptians are very proud of being sort of the largest Arab majority country, the heart of the Arab world, the cultural seat of the Arab world, and something that was actually activated in Egyptians when they saw what happened in Tunisia. It was sort of this moment where they thought, well then why not us, right?
So I think 5 or 6 days after the process started to happen in Tunisia, Abdurrahman, the other admin, was an activist. So we always had these fights together about, no, we're not going to do this. And that's my side. And he's like, no, we have to do it. No, we are not going to do this. So we had this argument about Tunisia. And he's like, I'm posting photos about Tunisia. I said, do not. We're not posting anything about Tunisia. And at that time, I was really kind of scared of disappointments that would arise if the Tunisia, we don't know where's this heading. People are protesting in the street. And by basically showing people, that we sort of endorse this, we're kind of telling people to do this. So first of all, we are, asking people to be confrontational. And second, we don't know where's this going. It might end up with more disappointing of the people. And by the way, I remember one of the very strong comments one wrote on the page. I used to read most of the comments on the page. They were like about 10,000 a day. I was not working at Google. I'm not doing my job. So
you were still getting paid by Google, but not actually
doing
the job.
No. I was working at Google, and I was doing my job, but...
There are no Google execs in the audience, so we're...
Yeah, but they can watch it.
Yeah, that's right. They're everywhere. It's true. They're the mukhabarat.
That's what the state security thing. So one guy told me, said in a very touching comment, is that I wished I never have subscribed to this page because I was exposed to many things I never knew and I wished I did not knew about my country. So it was very frustrating experience, I have to say, what we were taking people through. You were basically telling them everything bad about what's happening in the country. And to a large extent, you're not celebrating anything good because at the end of the day, there are many venues that does that all the time. This page is all about human rights and you always show the cases of violations and you're frustrating and disappointing a lot of people. So I did not want this disappointment to happen if we expose Tunisia. And then one thing that happened on the 13th that just, made me like, oh, wow, because on the 13th, of January, Ben Ali, for the first time in my life since I was born, I see an Arab dictator speaking to his people, apologizing. So he was saying, I was sorry, now I understood you, and things are going to change. Despite the fact that a few days before that, before the events were, he said these are, thugs and people who want to do chaos, funded by foreign, the typical dictator taglines. And when he did that, I started to look like, wow. And then I asked people, should we discuss the Tunisian situation on the page? And over 70% said yes. We want to see updates about what's happening in Tunisia. And next day, he left. And as you just mentioned, Egyptians think of themselves as the leaders of the Arab world. And this was one thing. It wasn't the main thing. The main thing was, we always never thought that you can get hundreds of thousands of people in the streets and who insist on people want to topple the regime, and it will happen. None of us have envisioned this. Even those who were, thinking of a revolution, none of them envisioned that this is the way. And this is why I honestly think the spark of the Egyptian revolution was the Tunisian revolution. We saw a model. We saw a great example. It was basically a crash course on how to topple a dictator. And while we saw a lot of hope and we thought this is can happen in Egypt, the regime thought completely the opposite. No. Egypt is not Tunisia. It's a completely different scenario, and we're in a much more stable position. And they were taken by surprise, because the moment I put the first post, we were planning. Abdurrahman earlier have suggested that we sort of like celebrate the police day in our own way, which was on 25th, basically doing silent stands or thinking of, doing a wall of fame and a wall of shame for good police officers and bad ones. Yet on that day, I just, happened to write, without really thinking, I was just reading the comments and everyone was, energized, we have to do something, and people were making even jokes. If Bouazizi set himself on fire, the admin of Khaled Said would have called for a silent stand. Mm-hmm. Like the Tunisians have done a revolution and these guys are just going to do a silent stand. So when I wrote, just today is the 14th, and in 10 days we're going to have the police day. If 100,000 of us take to Cairo, to the streets of Cairo, no one is going to be able to stop us. And the feedback was very positive. And, people are like, yes. And it just... The wisdom of the crowds first made most of us brave, and got us really into this. I was never before this moment ready to say that I would sacrifice my life for this moment to happen. But then after that, it just got into me, and I was very ready. I did not mind taking any kind of risks, because if I see a success case, I'm willing to replicate and pay the price, whatever it is. So the Tunisian experience was really good. And then the next was that the fact that this invitation came from an anonymous page, the event was not personalized. It was not personalized to a group, a movement, or an individual. It was basically out there in the web sphere.
It was leaderless, yeah.
And everyone was adopting it. And people, I detailed in the book, I'm not going to say the whole thing now because you probably need to buy the book.
Yeah, you don't want to give that away.
Yeah, we did I would say one of the best marketing campaigns ever, because it was done by everyone. Everyone took part of it, and everyone in his own way. People would create interesting banners. In fact, one guy, next day, only 24 hours from the invitation, sent me a design which was basically the resignation letter, Mubarak stepping down on 25th of January. And that just shows how people were brilliant, and people coming up with SMS campaigns ideas, printing papers that would, had some guy was sent me a photo of himself, I printed these, and he's smiling with, the pile of papers, and I'm going to go and distribute them in the street to tell everyone that there is something happening on Jan 25th. And because of that, the invitation only online reached over 1 million Egyptians before Jan 25th.
And in fact, on that day, hundreds of thousands of Egyptians poured out onto the streets. That was the first moment, I think, in which people realized, oh, this is happening. And then, of course, 3 days later, the so-called Day of Rage, where even larger crowds began to show up. And at that moment, I think the entire world all of a sudden recognized Mubarak's done with. The problem is that you didn't get a chance to experience any of that because you were in a prison cell. I don't want to give too much of that story away because it's a really great part of the book, and you should all buy the book and read it. But
I'm donating all the proceeds. So
yes, but
so
but,
I can be free saying please buy the book.
Yeah, but if you we're this is America. We just. I don't know if you heard, but money is your voice in this country. We've the Supreme Court. Very quickly, if you don't mind, we don't need to get into the whole experience. You were in prison for 11 days. 12,
yeah.
11 days. You went through some very terrible experiences. They're I think, quite vividly brought out in the book. But I just want to ask you one question about that experience.
Which I wasn't tortured physically, just in case, you know, so your imagination...
You were mentally... I think it's very... It's correct to say you were mentally and emotionally tortured. But what I wanted to ask you is that here you sort of, in a way, kind of were at the launch of the single most, you know, important movement in, you know, in modern Egyptian history, and you were in a prison, so you had no idea what was going on. You had no idea that there were hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people on the street in Egypt. They wouldn't tell you anything, would they?
No, not at all. And that was the hard, you know, that was the hardest part of it, that I was blindfolded, handcuffed all the time, including, you know, even when I was eating, handcuffed and blindfolded. Basically, they wouldn't let me get exposed to anything that was happening outside. And so I was pretty much waiting for the unknown. My family doesn't know where I am because I was kidnapped from the street at 1 a.m. And sometimes I have all these mixed feelings. One time I think, okay, there must be, you know, people are winning in the street, and this is why they're keeping me, because probably they, you know, think... And I think that was completely wrong, that I could be of influence outside, because this was a truly leaderless movement. Yes, the page helped promote the Jan 25th, but after that, the revolution was on the street. You know, people were protesting on 26th, on 27th, and on 28th. Yeah, probably we guided the location, but the revolution was literally on the street. People are done. They broke their fear, and they're not waiting for anyone to tell them anything.
They jumped from the virtual to the real. It was now.
And there are many people who are not even on the virtual world. Right. I mean, at the end of the day, what Jan 25th did, breaking the fear. And many Egyptians, you know, you will find a lot of... I saw one of the activists on the ground said that we are going to start the protest on Jan 25th from the poor areas, neighborhoods. So they would, you know, 200, 300 people start from there and start going, and people are joining them. So you ended up on Jan 25th seeing many people who did not even probably know how to read or write are there protesting because they were influenced by the others. So that was part of a moment that you think that everything is going well, and this is why probably you kept here. Or another, you know, thing that say, okay, it looks like, you know, it's done. They managed to stop it, and at the end of the day, after they stopped it, I have no value, and they're just keeping me to pay the price of what I've done. Right. And that was the hardest part in the whole experience.
Yeah. So we're gonna open the floor to questions. There's a mic there. There's a mic there, and you can just kind of stand in line, and we'll call on you in a minute. If you are too lazy to actually get up, you can always tweet a question. To us, you can tweet directly to Aslan Media Live if you want, and hashtag Gonim LA. But as people are lining up, I do want to just sort of ask one question, which is the question that I said that I would come to. The unthinkable happened. Mubarak left. We're sort of a year into this process. We talked about the challenges that are taking place right now. We also talked about the fact that you're very optimistic in the future. Just, if you will, end this part of the discussion here by giving us a sense of what that optimism is like. How do you see Egypt a year from now?
Well, I'm optimistic because optimism is not a choice. I mean, I understand. I'm not that naive to underestimate the amount of problems and challenges this country might be facing in the next few months and probably in the next few years. I see it very well, and I know that this recovery is gonna be very hard, and there are lots of sacrifices that are needed, over the time. Yet, I have not seen, a nation that is pessimistic that manages to do anything positive. So I don't think optimism is a choice for me. I have to always look at the good things and try and make sure that I stick to them and overcome the bad parts. The most critical part happening in the next few months is Egypt elects a new president. The power is completely transferred to whomever the people chose, as parliament, as and president. And then we have a constitution that basically ensures that what was institutionalized in the past, the corruption that was sort of institutionalized or giving giving the Pharaoh power to the president is no longer going to happen. And that power is distributed among different authorities so that we end up having a real democracy. I also wish to see that as the youngsters have more role to play in politics. We've been taken by surprise, which is fine because I believe, as I said, we didn't take to the street to basically rule Egypt. We took to the street because we wanted people to have a voice. So we need to regroup and find venues on how are we going to organize ourselves. And that happens after the end of the transitional period. So the most critical part now, whatever it takes in the next few months, is to make sure that the power is transitioned. We have done, if one thing we've done as a mistake in the after 11th of February is that we did not prioritize. We had so many things to tackle, and we saw so many things, we wanted so many things to happen, while the fact is, what should have mattered as number one priority is to ensure that we, as soon as possible, we run the elections and we do the transfer of power.
So we have about 15-20 minutes for questions. That means that we're going to have to ask you to just very quickly just ask a question. No speeches, no comments. Just ask a question so that we can get to as many questions as possible. Yes, ma'am.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
I'm a Palestinian American who was really watching the revolution in Egypt hour by hour on TV and on the internet, and I'm still cheering for the revolution to succeed and the country to gain back its leadership, inshallah. My question to you is, in one of the famous speeches that Hosni Mubarak gave, he said, "It's me or chaos." And I personally took that as a big threat. And sadly, I somewhat see some of the chaos is happening now. Do you see the hidden hands of Mubarak, his children, and those who are supporting him fulfilling that threat? And how are the young men and women of the January 25th revolution planning to deal with this to save the country?
Okay. Thank you. So, definitely, the situation in the country now is very hard to read and come up with a solid conclusion about what is exactly happening. So, for example, there has been a lot of conspiracies about the match that happened in Port Said, where over 70 people have died, and we've never had a case like that before in Egypt's history, football history. Yet, I would say that what matters now, or our role, is not to keep analyzing what is happening, because those who are creating these kind of events, if we assume that someone is behind it, is exactly wanting that. What we should do is to look at what should happen, and we make sure that it is happening. And it's very hard, and I have to say, a lot of activists, for example, when I say stuff like that, don't like it, and they think this is sort of escaping from the current events, while I believe there should be people who does focus on what is happening. But if all of us start becoming reactive, and this is one of our problems in the past, we used to be the ones leading the events, and everyone else was reactive during the 18 days. And that was the very powerful moment. You know, they were just doing whatever they were doing, and we did not care. We knew what we wanted. Everyone was reacting according to what the Tahrir Square revolutionaries were doing. So regardless of what they do, and I think at the moment the parliament have started issuing new recommendations that they want to be implemented as soon as possible, of separating everyone who is in the prison in different cells and making sure that they don't interact together, as well as having a more independent fact-finding committee looking after and analyzing the events, because there had been a lot of lives, as I said, died, and which is the worst thing that happened so far. I think this is the real problem. Forget the economy, forget everything else. People are still dying. And this is, to me and to many Egyptians, the most painful experience. I would say it's very important now to look at how can we, as soon as possible, end the transitional period. How can we get a president and a parliament, and then empower them and, you know, respect the choice of the people and work hand in hand with them in making sure that what happened, you know, Egypt before 25th of January is not going to be reproduced by any form after 25th of January.
And we did get a little bit of good news with that today. Field Marshal Tantawi, the head of SCAF, the military leadership, announced that they're going to accelerate the process for the presidential elections, and they'll begin accepting nominations on March 8th. We'll see. Yes.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
I myself am co-editing a book on the revolutionary movements in the Arab world and focusing on youth activists in social media. So I've been able to see across 8 different countries what has been going on. And certain themes come up a lot, especially this theme of fear that you mentioned, the fear barrier being broken. Another one that I found interesting is the conversation that each country, all the activists in each country are having with each other. You spoke a little bit about Tunisia and also how Tunisian activists were giving you guys tips as well when it came to how to respond to tear gas. So I'm wondering what other sort of conversations are being had online between all the other movements in the other countries, you know, specifically where you're sitting from your vantage point, and what an Arab regional identity you think might be forming.
It's been a long time since someone said pan-Arabism, but but people are talking about it. It's a new.
I think it's a very interesting perspective, and I believe now the FBI is going to be listening. I believe that, you know, looking at Syria, Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Morocco also to a certain extent has been having a lot of changes. It's looking very interesting. One interesting thing about the internet that we have seen, I don't know if you guys were familiar, during Egypt and Algeria, the qualification to the final cup in soccer, a huge problem happened. And internet has been used as a weapon to ignite that this problem. And it made a lot of Egyptians, and you know, Egyptians were creating songs basically talking bad about Algerians and vice versa. But one good thing that happened, for example, when Khaled Said died, there was the first group that was created in solidarity with Khaled from outside Egypt was a Tunisian group. There was about 1,000 Tunisians saying that, you know, we feel for you guys and we support you from far away. And I see this whole virtual pan-Arab movements getting created. Yeah, it's very virtual. It's scattered. It doesn't represent a large number of the population. But to a large extent, the young people are bridging together and sort of forgetting the older mentality of how these regions are working. Currently, each state is in its own isolated problems. Every country has a challenge. Libya has a challenge now of, you know, the militant groups, and you know, how are they making sure that there are no weapons with the people, and they're trying to integrate the militants into the army. Tunisia is still in the phase of the transitional period, doing their constitution. Egypt is still doesn't have a president, and we know Syria is definitely, you know, is in the hardest process at the moment. But as soon as things develop, I think there is a chance where we actually work together. And that if that would be driven by anyone, it would be driven by the youth who does not have the baggage in the past.
For sure.
We were not born in the, for example, the time when the Arabs tried to unite and failed. And I have to say, this should be something useful, something good, not just for the Arab world, but you know, for the whole world. You know, the more we communicate together, the more we'll build a better understanding, and we bridge the gaps and differences among us.
Virtual pan-Arabism. I think that just launched about a dozen dissertations. Yes.
Assalamu alaikum. So do you think before the revolution there was a problem with patriotism? I don't know if patriotism is the right word. I'm not just talking about political apathy. I'm talking about people owning their country and really caring about streets being clean, libraries being, you know, stocked with books, and really owning their country. I don't know how to say it better than that. And was there a problem in Egypt with that? And how can the Syrians learn from that example in the conversion process that you talked about, winning people over and having them care about their country?
So I think it's just the people. There was this common saying that this country is their country. A lot of Egyptians used to say that this country is their country, and "they're here" refers to the regime. the government, as the Egyptians like to call. And that was mainly driven by the fact that people did not feel they have a voice, and people also felt that they're not treated as citizens of a country they should be proud of. Yet, it was very awkward that, you know, you would find out that most of the Egyptians really love their country, and they love being Egyptian. Even those who traveled for so many years abroad, the Egyptian Americans, for example, would still tell you, I miss my country. I want to visit Egypt every now and then. I was so happy when the revolution happened. And there is this link and love for the country. And that was really empowered. The end of the book, the last statement I wrote before going to sleep on the night of 11th of February is that I'm proud to be Egyptian. So definitely, this revolution have given us a lot of hope that, you know, finally we own our country. We own the decisions that are made in the country. I believe that in Syria, the situation, I don't really understand the dynamics of the Syrian society, but to a large extent, the conversion is needed. At the end of the day, if you cannot convince the masses that this is for their best, and to make sure that you counter the media propaganda, then definitely you are going to make it harder. In Egypt, one of the very big basically reasons why this was going into this direction, despite the fact that the U.S. didn't want it, the army didn't want it, Mubarak didn't want it, basically the whole, you know, I don't think any of the Arab countries did want to see this as well.
The Israelis didn't want to see it.
Yeah, exactly. So pretty much no one wanted to see this happening, yet it happened. It was mainly because the people were on the side of the revolutionaries. We have this saying, I don't like to label people, but when they said the couch party, those who were basically sitting down, watching what's happening, and probably being neutral, they were not opposing what was going on. They thought, maybe these guys are good Egyptians, and finally will get us, away from what we were facing. So I really hope that this would be the case that is happening in Syria.
I'm going to move to that side, but first, can we get a question from the Twitterverse, Nicholas?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. There's a question here saying, what can be done strategically to persuade more traditional, in quotes, Egyptians to embrace the objectives of January 25 and revolution? What can be done strategically to persuade more traditional Egyptians to embrace the objectives of revolution, but people you mentioned who aren't really connected?
Well, yeah, so traditional Egyptians, we're all traditional Egyptians anyway.
I think, if I may, I think what the questioner...
Yeah,
asking,
I understood the question, yeah. I think one of the challenges, it's an ongoing challenge, is again that the conversion process need to happen. We need to keep explaining to the people. I remember one guy... Because there is sort of a smear campaign against a lot of the revolutionaries since the 11th of February. First, we were celebrated as the heroes of the country, but then it's very traditional when people get out of jobs, when they start paying the price, when they're feeling insecure, they're sort of eventually going to start feeling that this is not cool, you know, this is not good. I did not like Mubarak, but I was getting my salary on the 26th at the end of every month, you know. So this whole notion of, you know, it's not yet mainstream, but some people would come and say, oh, you want to you want to bring down the Egyptian army. And I say, no, I don't want to bring down the Egyptian army. I care for the Egyptian army. It's protecting our soil. I have a lot of respect to the brave soldiers and officers who are protecting me while I'm sleeping at home from the, you know, external dangers. And the guy looks at me and is like, really? You are really not interested in bringing down the Egypt? Yes, of course I'm not. I'm an Egyptian, right? So it's very important why I'm saying the story. While it sounds ridiculous that anyone would believe that the masses would think that, it is happening. And some people would start thinking because of the miscommunication, because of the propaganda, the messages that they are, you know, that they are exposed to, that they start believing that our intentions are not pure, and that we do not want the good for them. It's very important to over-communicate. It's very important to make sure that it's, 20 revolutionaries sitting down together is not going to do this country a better job. 20 of them, each one go in and talk to 20 different people, is what will make this keep going. Because revolution is a process. It's not going to end today. It's not going to end tomorrow. It's going to take some time until the demands are met. And at any moment of time, if we completely lose the public support, no matter what you do, it's not going to be it's not going to be effective.
We have time for two more quick questions. Yes, sir.
Ahmed El Hawari, Egyptian American. Wa'il, that's the name of my next son, inshallah.
That's nice of you.
I just found out you're married. Unfortunately, I would have offered you one of my beautiful daughters. I want to say, as an Egyptian American, I can raise my head high. I walk in the street. I've cried for days after the revolution, and I was really wanted to appreciate or say how much I appreciated all the effort that you put into it. I know Egyptians are hard to convince of what's right and what's wrong. It's easy to follow after a conspiracy theory here and a conspiracy theory there. Or, you know, Red Mercury, I don't know if you remember, Al-Zayb Al-Ahmar, and a million other things. I know it's a hard job, and I feel like I'm in the company of greatness, by the way, and you were brave in front or behind a keyboard. You have no idea how much greatness you've caused in this world, not just in Egypt, not just in the Middle East, but in the world. Occupy Wall Street, people still remember your name. What I really want to know, I would have killed to be here tonight. I would have killed to be here tonight, and I'm glad I made it. Your job is not finished. You know your job is just barely started. Okay, it's going to take a lot of work to convince 85 million people who are so used to being told what to do, what to say, what to think, what to feel. Education is the key. Your website made me learn so much. I knew what was happening, but I've never seen anyone show it to me in this such a light. Okay, it was wonderful to read your posts. Okay, regardless or not, you are a reluctant hero. You are a hero. Okay. What? Question in the end, are you willing to stick with it, to continue this path, to finish the job?
So I think we don't have an option now. After all these people dying for the cause, one of my favorite profile photos for the page, whenever something bad happens, is the no return sign. We're not going to go back. And there has been so many evidences that this is not going to happen. I think singling out someone like me and making him the hero and is pretty much unfair to millions of Egyptians. I have a friend, four days ago exactly, I was in a meeting at night. It was about 4 or 5 a.m. in Egypt, and I got a phone saying that he got shot in his left eye and he lost his left eye. And this guy was the one who designed the profile photo of the page that say that Egyptian blood is sacred. And he's a great designer who did most of the designs on the page. He went to the hospital. They did his left eye so that, you know, it doesn't look damaged. And next day he was in Facebook mentioning me on the post saying, well, you know, what should be our next design? And, you know, looking at people like this and thinking that this revolution is going to go in the wrong direction, I think is very hard. There are lots of people who are ready to pay whatever the consequences are. They have seen how bad it was to live under a dictatorship, and they're not going to be ready to accept that the dictatorship is continue happening, or it comes at a different expense. If that happens anyway, probably it would be at the expense of our lives.
I think the comment that was made is a great way to end, which is that this isn't just an Egyptian revolution, it's not just an Arab revolution, but it's a global revolution, and that what's happened over the last year, I think, has put autocrats across the world, and even here in the United States, on notice. The book is called Revolution 2.0, The Power of the People is Greater Than the People in Power. Wael Ghanim will be signing books, and we'll be able to continue the discussion outside. But Wael, shukran jazeeran. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you. Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.